Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is all of it. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Allison Stewart. Now that Halloween is over, it's safe to say the Christmas season has begun, at least according to chain drugstores and radio and TV ads. Sorry, Thanksgiving. Maybe you begin to think about presents or what books you want to pack for your time off during the holidays. Well, James Mustick might have a recommendation for you. In fact, he has 1,000. James Mustick began his career working in bookstores in the 1980s. In 1986, he co-founded the book catalog A Common Reader, and he is the founding editor-in-chief of Barnes & Noble Review. His first book is 1,000 Books to Read Before You Die, A Life-Changing List, is out. And James is in our studio. Nice to see you. I love this book. That's why I'm smiling so much.
Well, it's great to be here, and it's nice to see you smiling. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, 1,000. Why 1,000?
It came from the publisher.
Okay.
Workman Publishing. It was right up the street from your studios here. In 2003, they did a book called 1,000 Places to See Before You Die, which was very successful. Mm-hmm. And Peter Workman, who has unfortunately since passed away, wanted to make a series. And so one day he said to me, he knew my work from A Common Reader catalog. He said, I'd love to do one about books. Do you want to do it? So that's where the 1,000 came from.
Did you hesitate at all?
No, I did not hesitate at all. I hesitated a lot after I signed up for it. It took me 14 years to write the book because it was enormous and complicated to figure out how to approach it. But I was thrilled to be asked and to tackle it.
Now, do you have a you in mind, a person before you die?
No, it's just a generic, you know, any reader. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be clear, the book is really, it's an enormous menu. So when people feel like they want something to read, depending upon what they're in the mood for, they can find something in here. So it's not 1,000 books prescriptively that you have to read these. It's 1,000 books to choose what you're going to read next from. So it is very much meant to be part of the reader's agency is meant to be part of the book.
So it's not be thought of as a best of, or these the only books that you should read before you die.
No, not at all.
Well, it's sort of interesting because when you open up to the table of contents, it's alphabetical. Edward Abbey to Jane Austen, Franz Kafka to Tony Kushner. Yeah. And then you go to the back, which is a lot of fun, the way you arrange some of the books. Tell me about some of the categories. I love this one, especially 12 books to read before you're 12.
Yes. Yeah, so what I wanted to do was to present some ways into the book for people who might be looking, because the rest of the book, as you say, is alphabetical by author, but to give people a kind of sense of if they're looking for a particular thing, here's a group of them. So 12 books to read before you 12 have some of my own favorites and favorites of my daughters, who are both grown now, but remembering when they were those age. And a couple of them are Tuck Everlasting by Natalie Babbitt, Matilda by Roald Dahl, mm-hmm. The Mouse and His Child by Russell Hoban. Do you know that book?
I don't know that one.
This is a marvelous book. Now, Russell Hoban is the most interesting author because he's famous for two things. One is he wrote a series of books, picture books for little kids, Bread and Jam for Francis, Best Friends for Francis, about a little badger who's mischievous. Her parents can't get her to go to sleep. So he wrote those books. And then he wrote a number of quite sophisticated novels for adults, most famously Ridley Walker. And this book was the first full-length novel he wrote, The Mouse and His Child, and it's aimed at 12-year-olds, but I say this without any qualification for age. This book has more of real import to say about being alive on the earth than any book I know.
Wow.
So I can't recommend it highly enough, whether you're 12 or 52. You know, The Mouse and His Child by Russell Hoban.
And it's from what era? From
it's written in, I think, the early 70s, around that era. And there's also on the 12 books to read before you 12 from the mixed up files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler about two kids who get themselves locked into the Metropolitan Museum. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful story. And Charlotte's Web, perennial favorite. Abel's Island by William Steig. So, you know, to look for a group of books for children to read, or for parents to read with children, or in the case of The Mouse and His Child, for you to read at any age, that's what that category is meant to do.
I love that you have books to read in a setting.
Yes.
Because some of us don't have a whole lot of time, but we really like to still be able to read and keep it in our lives.
Yes, exactly. So that's that was the, you know, that's why that's the first list among this grouping of lists at the back of the book. And in there, there's 12 books. One, Love, Loss, and What I Wore, is a wonderful, it's a charming book by Eileen Beckerman, where she draws these little pictures of all of the outfits, the clothes she had through her whole life, from being a little kid to being a grandmother, with little vignettes from her life about the time of life that the clothing represents. It's just a totally charming book. There's another one by the great British playwright Alan Bennett, probably most famous for The History Boys, but this book called The Uncommon Reader, it's a little fable that he invented about what happens when Queen Elizabeth II chases one of her corgis out of Buckingham Palace and finds a mobile lending library, makes friends with the librarian, and becomes this avid, obsessive reader. And because she's the queen, she can invite all these authors to come to state dinners and so on. But it turns the whole monarchy into mayhem. It's just totally delightful and funny. And again, you can read it in a night. There's The Little Virtues by Natalia Ginsburg, a marvelous Italian author, the 20th century, second half of the 20th century. And this is a group of essays. It's about raising children. It's about marriage, but in a kind of indirect way. It's not a how-to book by any means, but it ends up telling you a lot of things that are relevant about your life. I think I say in the entry for this book, in my book, that she strips emotions down to their essences the same way Hemingway strips sentences down to just declarative statements. It's a marvelous book. So
those are great. We're speaking with James Mustick, by the way. The name of his book is 1,000 Books to Read Before You Die, a life-changing list. I also thought it was terrific that you put audiobooks here.
Well, I thought of that when we started to talk about books to read in a sitting. You know, I read all the time. That's what I do for a living.
Me
as
too.
A bookseller and as a writer. But I have bookshelves in my house filled with books with the bookmark on page 60. Because on a rainy day like this, you say, I have nothing to do. I'm going to start reading, I don't know, Great Expectations, whatever it is. And then the sun comes out and you get on with your life and you forget about it. But audiobooks allow us a way to continue, especially with longer books. So I do have for any of the books among the 1,000 where I know there is a very good audiobook, I mention that. But there's also a list here in the back of the book, 12 terrific audiobooks. I mentioned Great Expectations. There's an audiobook read by the British actor Martin Jarvis, which is just spectacular. Even if you've seen the various movies and read the book, it's worth listening to. And The Little Red Chair is by Edna O'Brien, read by the actress Juliette Stevenson. It's a very, very powerful book about, starts out in Ireland and ends up involved in the Balkan War. Mm-hmm. It's about being a refugee, what home means. It's a very, very powerful book, which the Irish novelist Edna O'Brien wrote in her 85th year, and it's just stunningly powerful. And
you have
a great
the Iliad?
Book. The Iliad, yep, read by Derek Jacobi. It's a terrific way to approach that work. So there's and surprisingly, a book you wouldn't think would be a great audiobook, Moby Dick. The one that's read by a man named Frank Muller. It is completely gripping. Even all the crazy stuff about whaling and the arcana of being on ship, just totally immersive.
The blubber and the whole thing.
Exactly,
and,
yes.
Yeah, and Queequeg, and yeah. This is another one I thought was interesting, another category, offbeat escapes. What does that mean exactly?
Well, most of these categories I left large enough that I could fit whatever I wanted in there. But offbeat escapes were books of travel, generally, where they're going to a strange place or with not the just kind of off the beaten path. So one of the books in there is called No Picnic on Mount Kenya, which is a book. It's a true story written by a man who was in a prisoner of war. He was an Italian soldier who was a prisoner of war in a British POW camp during World War II in Africa. And he and some of his companions, who were also prisoners, were from the Dolomites in Italy, a mountain climbing country. And this prison camp was at the base of Mount Kenya, the second highest peak in Africa. So they decide that they're going to escape from the prison camp and climb the mountain because this is what they love to do. And they leave a note for their British captor saying, don't come look for us. We're coming back. We just want to go climb the mountain. And then they have a harrowing adventure on the mountain. It's just a terrific book and surprising. Another one on that list is The Auberge of the Flowering Hearth by the food writer Roy Andres de Groot. And that begins, he's sitting in Greenwich Village in a, another true story, in a restaurant, looking at a bottle of chartreuse. He just had an after-dinner drink. And he reads the label about the monks in France who make this drink according to a special recipe. And he says, I'm going to go find out about that. And he travels there, meets these two women who have this inn, which is the auberge of the title. And it's all about their recipes and the seasons. He goes back and back, just a totally transporting book.
One of the things I think is also great about the book is that your descriptions, they're only a page long. Mm-hmm. It's not, I mean, otherwise this book would would be far too large for anybody to have and carry around. And was that intentional to be as brief as possible? And how did you do it when you're dealing with such great works?
Well, that's one of the reasons it took me 14 years to write the book. I think it's Mark Twain who somewhere writes a letter to someone where he says, I'm writing you this long letter because I didn't have enough time to write you a short one. And that's generally true. If you want to make something compact and concentrated where every word tells, it's harder. It takes longer. But I wanted the book to be really an invitation to these books, not a critical discourse on them. I think what I have to say about them is intelligent and informed and all of that. But I really want it to be an invitation where I could tell people just enough to say, oh, this sounds interesting. I understand the context of the author or the work. Mm-hmm. I kind of know what the book is about from this, and now I'd like to read it. That was what I was looking for. So it's as a bookseller, that's what I do, to try and, find somebody who's looking at something or asking a question and to give them enough to get excited about it. And that's what I tried to do in the essays.
We're speaking with James Mustick about his new book, 1,000 Books to Read Before You Die, A Life-Changing List. Do you... I know you believe that books are life-changing, but why do you believe books are life-changing?
Well, I think they're life-changing because they keep us in touch with the best parts of ourselves. So much of our world these days is dictated by news feeds or by algorithmic targeting that even our choices now are kind of predetermined. And when we're reading, we create a space in our head where we aren't directed by someone else. I mean, we're conversing with the author or with the characters, but we're creating a world and able to create a space where our inner life is. Mm-hmm. And we can explore the interests that we don't have the time to explore in our busy days, and also explore feelings and to hear the voice of other people in a non-threatening way within the book that allows us to grow, to be more generous and more compassionate, more kind, more informed. So I think as a spark to wonder, as a spark to thoughtfulness, it enhances our life in a way that is life-changing or life-enhancing, I believe.
It's also can be like meditation in many ways, because yes, there's nothing else that can come in if you're actually really deeply involved with your reading. Yeah. It's just that focus, that singular objective to read this book.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think that kind of nurturing a space that's removed from what we do, but connected to it by whatever the subject of the mm-hmm. book may be, is a very important thing.
You have one Harry Potter book in here.
I only have one because I figure whoever's going to start is going to keep going. So I didn't put all seven in, but it's there to represent the whole series because it's such a marvelous really prompt to reading for so many people. I know my elder daughter was just about the age to read it when the first book came out and kind of grew up with Harry Potter. And so the whole series is wonderful.
What is the most recent book that you have in the list?
The most recent book was published last year, 2017, by Ellen Ullman, called Life in Code, A Personal History of Technology. Ellen Ullman is a very interesting writer. She wrote her first book around the year 2000, a little bit before, called Close to the Machine, and it was about coding. She was a software programmer in the very early days of Silicon Valley and one of the first, the only women in that role at that time. And so that Close to the Machine book, which is really about, has the feel of what a coder does, became something of a classic. And she went on to write two novels, By Blood and The Bug. And this book is a collection of essays about living in the technological age, You learn a lot about coding, but you learn a lot more about life. It's really about how technology is shaping our lives for good and in many ways for ill. And she just writes beautifully. I think I say in the book, if Virginia Woolf had written A Laptop of One's Own, it would have been a book like this. It's marvelous.
You also have sort of pop fiction in here. Stephen King is represented. Carrie.
Yes.
Why Carrie of all of them?
Stephen King is such a he's such a fertile writer. I don't know how he writes so many books. All of them have much to recommend them. Carrie was his first book, and in it, it was he really, as he said, he taught himself how to scare people, and if he didn't scare people, he was going to gross them out. And it's kind of an early book. I also have a later book by him, 11-22-63, mm-hmm. kind of alternative history of the Kennedy assassination to show his growth as a writer. But his embrace of the word and his ability to get readers on board for enormous books of real import is why he's there.
And you mentioned about Charles Dickens. You called him the most ingenious author in English literature. Well, why does he hold that title for
Dickens
you?
is a great favorite of mine. And to me, he is an author in search of a story. You follow his sentences through his books. It's like you're walking across London, and he's inventing this as he goes along. He's describing a real city, but is all of this energy and ingenuity in the service of him writing, because he is just, it's almost like a musician who loves to play, and he just keeps writing, and to go along with him on the ride is just spectacular.
Are there any guilty pleasures in here?
Oh, there's lots. There are, there's lots of mysteries and so, you know, I don't know if we should be guilty about them as much as just enjoy them. But I like to say readers read the way they eat. So they might have a hot dog or a taco one day, and the next night they're going to go out to a fancy restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I think so all of those so-called guilty pleasures are important to as part of our reading diet, so to speak.
And before I let you go, I mentioned to you that tomorrow our show is going to be dedicated to mental health and taking care of oneself in this post-election world. And you have one of your verticals here is soul food.
Yes.
Could you suggest maybe a book or two that people might want to think about reading after the election?
Part of that depends upon how it goes, but the election, I mean. But I would suggest there's a wonderful book on that list called Time and the Art of Living by a man named Robert Gruden. And it's a very calm book. It's written in very short sections that are numbered, so it's almost like a devotional in a way. But he just reflects upon time, and it's about thoughts on time as he's looking out a train window. There's also philosophical concepts, but it's very easygoing, but it really kind of puts us in the element in which we really live and takes us out of the momentness of our lives, which is driving many of us crazy.
1,000 Books to Read Before You Die is available now. James Mustick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Next on All of It, we're taking a peek inside the final days of The Late Show with David Letterman, and later we'll hear all about plans to celebrate and commemorate the 60th anniversary of the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. I'm Allison Stewart. All of It will be back after a quick break. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. After making audiences laugh for 33 years, on May 20th, 2015, David Letterman said thank you and good night for the very last time. It was an end of an era. The final 6 weeks of the show welcomed big-name guests Julia Roberts, George Clooney, Oprah Winfrey, the Obamas. In a new book, The Last Days of Letterman, The Final 6 Weeks, author Scott Ryan conducted interviews with the staffers of David Letterman's show. The writers, directors, producers, and stage managers offer a behind-the-scenes look at what it takes and what it's like to work on one of these shows, including revealing what it takes to write a top 10 list, book a president for a guest spot, and what it takes and what it's like to work in the classic Ed Sullivan Theater. They helped make The Last 6 Weeks 28 unforgettable episodes of late-night TV. Let's take a quick listen to some of Dave's final top 10.
Number 2, Tina Fey.
for finally proving men can be funny.
I like that. Things I've always wanted to say to Dave. Number one, Bill Murray, ladies and gentlemen.
Dave, I'll never have the money I owe you.
Oh, no.
The Last Days of Letterman is published by Fayetteville Mafia Press, and we're happy to welcome Bill Scheff to the studio, longtime Letterman writer. Hi, Bill.
It's good to be here, and I need to point out immediately that that clip you played, those two entries in the top 10, were not written by any of the writers. They were written by our writer's intern the last 3 months, Carolyn Shaper, who was a lovely, very funny woman who now works over at Full Frontal with Samantha Bee. So we're really proud of her.
Wow, that's a pretty great job, a resume for that young woman.
Yeah, she was, it was the type of thing where a lot of people that got hired as writers on the show started in other positions at the show, like receptionists and talent coordinators, and they would first turn in like monologue jokes to me and get a couple on, and maybe they would turn in a top 10 or two, mm-hmm. and many were hired. Jill Goodwin comes to mind, who was a wonderful writer for us for the last 3 years of the show, and Lee Ellenberg, and Lee's buddy that he wrote with, who I love, Jeremy Weiner, mm-hmm. and many others.
So how did the whole staff react when you heard, when Dave said, you know what, this is it?
Well, I remember being summoned down an hour earlier than I used to go down in the dressing room, and I guess other people felt the same way. It was the day after we had done a great show with Bill Murray and Lady Gaga, and we'd gone over to Roseland, and he was asking us down in the dressing room early, a bunch of senior staffers, and I assumed either it was one of two things. Either it was, that was a great show that we did last night, and let's try and do one of these every night. Mm-hmm. Or the test came back, and you know, I've got 2 weeks to live. I thought it was one of those two things. I didn't think it was, I decided to retire. And we were all there, and we all kind of did various things with our breathing. And then Kathy Mavrikakis, who is a senior producer, started to applaud, which was very smart of her, and mm-hmm. so did and the rest of us did. And I remember I can't speak for everybody else, but I thought two things: great, we're all going to get to go out together, all of us that have been with the show for so long. And the second thing was, I was very happy for Dave because, unlike anybody else in that field, he got to go out in his own terms.
I want to bring Scott Ryan into the conversation. Scott wrote the
book. Why would you do that? Scott, other than the fact that he wrote the book.
So, Scott, why did you decide to focus on the final 28 shows, just those shows?
Well, I felt that if you tried to cover the entire Late Show or all of Dave's career, it would just be too big. I mean, he was on TV for 33 years, and I thought that if we really focused in on these 28 episodes, that you'd get a real look at how all of the episodes went. So I like to say in the beginning, I'm just going to ignore 32 and a half years. What could possibly have happened in that amount of time?
So you interviewed staffers, folks, writers, stage managers. Did you get a sense of how they wanted to approach the final shows? Was it a different approach, or they just want to just go out strong, doing the exact same thing they've been doing those 32 and a half years before?
No, I actually think that it almost weighed on them. I think they knew, I remember Jerry Foley said that they knew that what Dave did on that stage, especially the last week, the last episode, that would be his legacy. And I think they all brought their A game to try to do the best they could do for Dave. And I think they did. I think those 28 episodes are the best episodes that they did.
What do you think, Bill? Do you agree with that?
Well, who am I to disagree with that? But no, I think that the fact that he chose those last 6 weeks, because I think that we really pointed to that. I think it was those were the 6 weeks after we got back from the last hiatus week, the last week that we weren't in production. And so we really view that as the final push, even though we'd been working on various elements in those last shows for months before. But I think the idea was, in a perfect world, to leave with no regrets. Mm-hmm. And I think we did that.
And Scott, what was the booking process like in those last weeks? Because these are the final guests, to your point about people who remember these last shows. These are the final guests you're going to have. So what were those conversations like? And was the booking process, was it difficult? Or did people just jump in and say, I'm on for Dave's last shows?
Yeah, I talked to Sheila Rogers, and mm-hmm. she was in charge of that. And she said nobody told them no. I mean, everyone wanted to do it.
If I could just hop in, not only did nobody tell us no, but people wanted to come on a couple times.
Oh, funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. 6 weeks, 5 weeks,
yeah.
4 weeks.
Yeah,
why not?
Yeah.
I've got more to say. Yeah. But to me, that's why these episodes are so great, because it wasn't people coming on to hawk a book. You know, I doubt you would have me on today if I wasn't selling this book just to catch up with me. But that's what happened on those shows. And that's an amazing moment in television.
And it was interesting. You pointed to that Sarah Jessica Parker was the first of the last.
Correct.
And she sort of set the tone. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, she really turned it on Dave, and you can see him being very uncomfortable. He doesn't want to take it, and Sarah looks at him and says, you're going to take it like a man, and she pours her heart out to him, and I think that set the bar and sort of allowed other guests to torture Dave.
Yeah. Good word.
Why would that be torture for Dave? You know,
because like a lot of people, like a lot of us, you know, Dave, If you scream a compliment at him, he doesn't hear it. But if you whisper an insult from a mile away, he hears it. And so he did not want people saying things to him that he had to process mm-hmm. in front of millions of people. But you know what? Tough luck. Here they come. And Paul used to tease him about it. Paul would come in, we'd be up in the dressing room, and Paul would come in before the show and say, you know, I know you don't want me to do this, because just about every guest would come out and say, you know, I know you don't want me to do this, and then they would do it.
We're speaking with Scott Ryan, author of The Last Days of Letterman, The Final 6 Weeks, and Bill Schaeft, a longtime writer for Letterman, who wrote the foreword to the book. When you first started working at Letterman, he gave you a piece of advice. What was that?
It was don't eat gas station sushi was the piece of advice that he gave me. But I think what you're referring to is, this is the day before I got the job, so I didn't mm-hmm. I wasn't even sure I was going to get hired. He said to me, never write a joke more than 4 lines, because even if it's great, it's not going to fit on a cue card. And I can't do anything that doesn't fit on a cue card. And of course, over my 24 years, 4 lines became 3 and then became 2 lines. And I rarely wrote a joke longer than 2 lines in the last dozen years I was with the show.
Does that speak to the simplicity of the beautiful simplicity of the Dave Letterman show? If it's funny, it's funny, and you can get to it.
Well, I think that's a part of it. But I also think that our job was, and I've said this many times, you know, the writers wrote some stuff that was funny, we wrote some stuff that was okay, and we wrote some stuff that was lame, but inevitably the funniest moments on the show was Dave reacting in the moment, and mm-hmm. that none of us could write, but the goal of all of us on the staff, writers, producers, etc., was to get Dave to a place where he was eligible to be comfortable enough to just go wherever he wanted to go. So the 2 lines were just a setup and a punchline, but if he liked the joke, that would be, you know, he would kind of riff on it and get very comfortable with it. It was very conversational.
There's so many, you know, over the 33 years that he was on TV in this role, so much changed, yet so many things on the show stayed the same. You knew you were going to get your top 10. You knew it was going to be Paul. You knew there'd probably be music. What was the thought behind keeping things the same when the world is changing around you?
Well, I think that I agree that there were elements on the show that stayed the same, that were signposts that people were comfortable with. But I think the comic sensibility on the show, well, I was there 24 years. Mm-hmm. I want to say it changed a half dozen times because, you know, when the show started, think about this, in 1982, Dave was 33 years old and his writers were in their late 20s and early 30s. And when he left in 2014, he was 67, and you know, the writers were, I mean, other than me, you know, the writers were in their 30s and 40s, and so his sensibilities changed, the world changed, the delivery system changed. So I think that we always adjusted. I don't think we ever got enough credit for adjusting.
Interesting.
Because I think other shows began after us and looked different. And their presentation was different. So therefore, they were different. But I think we I think that he was not topical at NBC and for the first couple of years at CBS. And then I think he became more topical. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I love to point out about him is the things that he was criticized by other people at NBC, like that his monologue was short and kind of rambling and that he wasn't a great interviewer. Those became two of his strongest suits. I mean, the monologue, I think, got very strong. And I think as an interviewer, I think he became unparalleled.
He was great at asking any question.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah. And I think that he, you know, and he wanted to have a conversation. He didn't want to go note by note and plug by plug. Mm-hmm. He wanted to, and some people were capable of that and some people weren't, which I'm sure you've dealt with. You may be dealing with it right now.
No, it's the joke in my house is my sister's a dentist, and sometimes I say, you're not the only one that pulls teeth for a living occasionally. We're talking to Scott Ryan, author of The Last Days of Letterman, The Final 6 Weeks, and Bill Sheft, longtime writer for Letterman. Scott, as you were talking to the folks who worked at Letterman, some of them had been there most of their careers, and as they're creating the end of this show, I mean, they were people who were losing their jobs, and they were people who were leaving home in many ways. They were going to have to go someplace else. Did they share that with you, and do you think that had an impact on the shows they produced?
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because I think that, of course, the book is about Letterman and the Late Show, but to me, there's a theme through this book that is about what's happening in America, where you sort of lose your job to a bigger corporation. The Worldwide Pants produced The Late Show. So this really was a mom and pop company. CBS didn't own them. They did it all, and you started as an intern and you ended up as the executive producer of the show. I mean, that doesn't happen. I mean, he mentioned Jill Goodwin as a writer. She answered the phones to begin with, you know. That doesn't happen in today's America.
That's old school,
and yeah, it really was. And so, yes, to us, you know, as viewers, me as a fan, I'm losing Dave as my TV friend, but they were losing this comfort, this home, and they really did share it with me. As we talked longer, you know, you would start veering off, and you know, one of my favorite interviews was the HR lady.
Oh, Janice Bonino, who is not from this earth.
Yeah,
from this earth.
Yes, she was such a, you know, she had never given an interview in her life before, and she was like, why do you want to talk to me? But that's where you get the story of what really went on at this job.
Yeah, the point that I like to make is in February of 2012, Dave celebrated his 30th year in late night, and we did a top 10. And it was things I've always wanted to say to Dave, and it was the longest tenured staffers, okay? So we had 10, okay? I had been with the show 20 years at that point. I didn't come remotely close to making that top 10 list because there were people that had been there much longer. You know, Barbara Gaines and Jude Brennan worked for them for 35 years. Rob Burnett was there for for 30 years. And many people in their 20s and high 20s, you know.
You know what else? You don't see consistency like that in media anymore.
No.
People who stay in one place and really, you know it and believe in it and are part of it. I think that's something that's missing in many ways.
I agree, and he engendered that type of loyalty. And, you know, you work in television, and you understand that most of the time you're working for someone who, you know, out of the side of your mouth, you're saying, I'm smarter than her. What is this? Why does this haircut have the job? But Dave was a guy you aspired to his level of knowledge and his proficiency. You know, we had a lot of writers, but he was always going to be the best writer. We had a great award-winning director, but he was a wonderful director, Dave. And we, you know, he was the best segment producer. He was a guy that you aspired to. And also, with people that are that long-term, that stay there for that long, you saw people grow up and fall in love and have families. And, you know, we were right over Broadway, so the Macy's Parade would go by, when it went down Broadway, mm-hmm. would go by the building. And I'm telling you, and we would always do shows on Thanksgiving because Dave didn't want to be with his family, which we loved him for, because some of us didn't want to be with our family. And the kids running around that day to see the parade from the windows, because my window overlooked Broadway. And it was... it was just a wonderful thing. You know, Nancy Agostini, who was produced the show on the floor the last 3 years. When I met her, she was 20, and she was living in an all-women's hotel. And she was, you know, she was a senior producer, and she ran that show mm-hmm. from the floor.
The name of the book is The Last Days of Letterman, The Final 6 Weeks. It's written by Scott Ryan. Scott, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you. And I'm sorry that I messed up your last guest because he had 1,000 books to read. Now he has to update it to 1,001.
Could have been a writer for Letterman, this guy.
Yeah, and that was nice and short. That was just 2 lines. Well done.
Bill Sheff, thanks so much for coming to the studio.
My pleasure.
Stay with us on all of it because it's the 60th anniversary of the Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater. We're celebrating with choreographer Rennie Harris and artistic director Robert Battle. That's in just about a minute. Stay with us. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater made its world premiere at the 92nd Street Y on March 30th, 1958, during a one-night-only performance. Since then, this world-renowned dance company has reached millions of audience members and traveled across the globe. The Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater is now the principal dance company of the New York City Center, which is where the 60th anniversary season will open on November 28th with a 5-week run that will introduce new works as well as showcase some of Ailey's lesser-known pieces. The season will feature a new production by the company's artistic director, Robert Battle. Hi, Robert.
Hi.
As well as the world premiere of a new piece by choreographer Rennie Harris. Hi, Rennie.
Hey, how's it going?
They are both in studio. So, Robert, you said in an interview earlier this year that Alvin Ailey wanted this company to be a mirror to society.
Mm-hmm.
How is that going to be reflected in the 60th anniversary year?
Gosh, in many ways. First of all, in the dancers, who really are, I think, a wonderful example of what humanity can be, you know, mm-hmm. And the way they express themselves, that you leave the performance uplifted. So that's first of all.
We can all use that.
We can all use that right now, right? But also, it's really a time to reflect on Alvin Ailey himself, the man, you know, the wonderful choreographer. That's why we're doing a program called Timeless Ailey, mm-hmm. which really looks at some of the works that really made the company what it is today. One of those works is called Cry. And Cry was a gift for his mother because he couldn't afford to buy her one. And so in 1971, wow. he made Cry on the legendary Judith Jamison. And he always says it is dedicated to Black women everywhere, especially our mothers. So that alone is mm-hmm. an example of how it really holds a mirror to society. It really celebrates life through dance.
Now, Rennie, you're premiering the company's first 2-act work, is that correct, Lazarus?
Yes.
All right, so tell me, the music sounds great. It's Terrence Trent D'Arby, it's Nina Simone, Darren Ross. Tell me about the musical choices.
You know, that was the first part was I chose Darren Ross to do the score because he's mm-hmm. crazy enough. once you get him on track, then he's like a hound dog and he figures these things out engineer wise and composition wise. It's like like no other person I've ever met before. And so that was the key at first. And then we just started shooting music back and forth over online, mm-hmm. like for like months. Like, oh, he's like, well, what do you think about this? It's kind of looking at, checking out aesthetics mm-hmm. and sounds and stuff like that. And then finally, one of the things I thought of, I was, oh, Terrence Trent D'Arby. Like he's a beast. So mm-hmm. so it's just like let's use so I said this is what I think I want to do, and so we decided actually to use one of the songs, but then we created sort of this aesthetic based on this on that particular song as well. So that's how the music kind of came along slowly.
And what about the two acts?
Well, Robert called me. He's like, yeah, I was thinking maybe you could do like, you know, maybe do an hour, you know, two. Like, I was like, what? He's like, yeah, I was thinking, you know, you could do an hour. I was like, an hour? Like, are you kidding me? Like, I'm having a problem with the 20-minute piece. And so that was massive. And so that freaked me out. And actually, I remember saying, man, you should have called me a year ago. Like, you know, and that was already a year out.
Yeah.
So I started, I think this was the first time I actually started to write things down. Hmm. Normally, I just go in and create, and then I felt like I wanted to be prepared this time, you know, not like messing around. So I started writing things, ideas down, like things to play with certain music and certain samples and to copy and all that kind of. And you know, I was stressed about the hour. I hadn't figured it out yet. I didn't even know if I had an hour, to mm-hmm. be real honest. I was already prepared. I told Darren, like, look, we may have to go in and say, look, man, we got like 45 minutes. What you want to do? But yeah, I was stressed about the hour, but once it kicked in and I really sort of understood the abstract narrative that was coming out of the work itself, mm-hmm. That's when I was okay. I knew we were going to make that hour, you know, of work. And so I'm excited about it, you know, to be honest. It's the first time they've ever had a choreographer mm-hmm. set an hour.
Yeah.
You know, and a street dance choreographer on top of that.
Well, I was going to ask if the writing it all down, how, you know, it's hip hop, it's street dance. Is that hard to do? Like, as it's such an emotional and such an outburst of energy with mm-hmm, mm-hmm. hip hop dancing. And you said you had to write it down. How'd you do that?
Well, you know, I had the luxury. Judith Jemison, I think it might have been 2003 or something, or something 04. Like that. 2004. I was actually jogging, and Judith Jemison called me and said, "Hey, this is Judith Jemison." I was like, "Hold on, who?" So anyway, so I had the luxury. Her invited me originally to do Love Stories, and then almost every average of 4 to 5 years after that, I guess, or a couple years after that, I was brought back to create other works. Mm-hmm. And so the great part was this, I have almost like 90% of all the dancers I started out with years ago.
Oh, mm-hmm. So there's institutional knowledge with your people.
Right. Yeah. So I was able to not to stress so much about the vocabulary, because the vocabulary mm-hmm. is street, but it's me. Because, you know, as a street dancer, we're all individualized, right? So I couldn't say, okay, we're going to see the nene, you mm-hmm. know, or see something like the whip. But, however, I'm creating it based on my understanding, you know what I mean? And because I'm a street dancer or choreographer. And so I was able to lean on a lot of the dancers, specifically from home. That was a turning piece, a turning point when I created that work for Ailey. And that kind of turned everything around after home. And then it was easier to get to Exodus and now. Mm-hmm. And now this one, yeah.
Do you want to add something to that? You were nodding your head.
No, yeah, I'm not. Well, first of all, you know, he's genius. So home, that was my first season mm-hmm. as artistic director. So, you know, I knew I needed to like get the best. So
bring it. Yep.
And so he did. And so it's I say it's like this conversation that, you know, when you have a good friend and you don't see them for a while, but mm-hmm. then you just take up where you left off, just as if no right. time passed.
Exactly how he calls me. Yeah. Hey, man, what's going on? Like, I ain't heard from you like 3 years.
Hey, about that piece. You know? So, and it's the same with the dancers, you know, that familiarity that mm-hmm. they come in. Instead of saying, like, who are you? It's saying, how have you been? And so that will translate to the audience.
Now, Rennie, you are the first official artist in residence with the company?
Yes.
Is that right?
So I'm hearing, yeah.
So why is he the first artist in residence?
Oh, why is he?
Yeah, what about him?
Because I said
so. No, I'm kidding. because, you know, what I know about Rennie and mm-hmm. what I perceive is that, you know, first of all, well, let me go back. The Ailey organization is, yes, it starts with the main company, but then we have a junior company, Ailey 2. We have an expansive Ailey school. We have arts and education programs. We have Ailey Extension, which is real classes mm-hmm. for real people. So there's a lot. And so when we have an artist like Rennie Harris coming to do such a large work, you know, oftentimes we don't have the through line of other aspects of the organization getting to work with that particular choreographer. Mm-hmm. So we thought that would be a wonderful thing to tie things together. Plus, Rennie is an educator. You know, when he speaks about hip hop, about the origins of street dance and the like, it really is an education that is very much necessary, especially when we see some of the dumbing down mm-hmm. of what it is. And so that was part of it. And just wanting to sort of deepen the relationship that Rennie Harris already has to the company and to the organization.
We're talking to Robert Battle from the Alvin Ailey Dance Theater and Rennie Harris, choreographer. So Rennie, when we talk about you as an educator, I'm going to put you on the spot for a minute. Can you educate us something you think is really, really important that people know about street dancing, that maybe they have a preconceived notion about it, but you would really like to set straight? And
you're gonna have to stop me. That's a lot. Well, you know, I think honestly what we see today as far as what's on video is and what's being taught in the dance studios, to me, is jazz with the attitude of street gangsters and what have you. Mm-hmm. So like Bad Boys, that kind of thing. Very rarely do we actually see this the street dance itself, the popular dance. If we see it, we see it with that particular artist. Like I was saying, like the Nae Nae or the mm-hmm. Whip or that kind of thing. We'll see it with that artist pushing it, but then we really don't see it that much in mainstream or what they've now called commercial or Hollywood hip hop, which is the isolation of jazz with sort of hip hop or mm-hmm. what's perceived to be as hip hop attitude. So I think that's not, in my opinion, what I would actually consider hip hop dance. Then second, the other thing is that people often lump all this stuff under one umbrella as hip hop. And hip hop is only one thing, and that's the party social dance. So therefore, if it doesn't have a name, you can challenge whether or not it's hip hop or not, right? And so they're different street. That's why I often will say, I might say hip hop and street dance or street dance, and to acknowledge all the other styles. Mm-hmm. So like popping, locking, breaking, crumping, light feet, you know what I mean? Harlem shake, hyphy, turfing, you know, jitting, juking, like all these other styles that come from around the country mm-hmm. that are specific to those particular places. And so often people put things under this umbrella. And I actually did it myself as well in the very beginning. But then quickly I realized that this wasn't necessarily true. The hip hop, the dance itself, was something that was specific, mm-hmm. you know, as a party social dance. And however, hip hop culture, of course, came first. You know what I mean?
You sent a lot of people to Googling real fast with that list, I'm sure. So, Robert, for you as a director of Alvin Ailey, why do you think this was a good idea? And all that Rennie just talked about, why is this what you want to bring into the 60th anniversary? Well, why is it relevant, and why is it important?
It's both those things, because what we really wanted to look at it, the 60th, we wanted to really celebrate the inspiration of the man who started it on the brink of the civil rights movement, 1958, Alvin Ailey, started this company because he didn't see the images that he wanted to see of his people reflected in concert dance, or the opportunities for dancers of color especially to express themselves on the concert dance stage. Mm-hmm. So it started as a movement, hip hop as a movement, you know, street dance as a movement. So to me, I saw the connection. And I wanted this piece to really be inspired by Alvin Ailey's life. And Rennie Harris is such a great storyteller. And I thought it would be a little bit unexpected that it would be through the lens of street dance. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of wanted to flip it a little bit that way. And so I think, too, I was also looking at cross-generational aspects of, you know, everybody has some concept of what they think hip-hop is, what they think street mm-hmm. is, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, they come with, oh, yeah, 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 I know what that is, right?
Yeah.
Which is fine, because it gets them to come into the theater and be curious. So that's why I wanted to do that.
So you're going to have grandmas with moms mm-hmm. and kids and shorties all in the seats.
Yeah, well, they're going to see something different, though. I think they're going to be surprised at it.
Yeah.
Alvin Ailey American Dance Theater's 60th anniversary season opens on November 28th at City Center. Robert Battle and Rennie Harris, thanks for coming to the studio.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to All of It on WNYC.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.